Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, you'll hear all about some local events Sinclair College and other partners have put together as the Laramie Project comes to the area, a conversation with Stephen Skiles of Sinclair's Theater Department. Also, we've got information on this year's Ohio Military Hall of Fame for Valor ceremony coming up May 4th at the Ohio State House. We've got poetry, politics, and more. First, WISO begins a new series today called Road Trip. For the next 5 months, Ohio radio producers will take us on audio tours based on a travel guidebook published in 1940 called The Ohio Guide. The Ohio Humanities Council has updated the guide, and the new Ohio Guide tours will take you to places you thought you knew and to fascinating out-of-the-way places you've never heard of. You can download the updated driving tours and take them for yourself. We'll tell you more about that later. But first, here's Sandra Slight Brennan, senior editor for the Road Trip radio series and the new Ohio Guide audio tours.
In the 1930s, unemployment was the highest that this nation has seen. Among the unemployed were writers and editors. The first Ohio Guide was part of President Roosevelt's Federal Writers Program to create jobs. Travel guides were written for most of the states as part of the American Guide series. The project started in August 1935. The state director in Ohio was Harlan Hatcher. He wrote about the project.
The Writers Project in Ohio employs 132 people in all capacities, including typists, research workers, writers, and editors.
They went to work collecting and writing material that would become the Ohio Guide. The 649-page book that was created talks about what life was like in the barometer state. Hatcher wrote,
"We have around 7 million people in Ohio now. They live in every imaginable kind of community. They are sprawled all over big, amorphous Cleveland. They live in more little towns and villages than the people of any other state."
The writers who worked for the Ohio Writers Project were sent to every county in the state and charged with finding facts about natural settings,
early history, later history, transportation, health and sanitation.
Gallia County has a lot of historical interest. Floods, raids, settlements.
The largest Hungarian colony in America is in Cleveland. When the wine grapes are harvested in October, men, women, and children.
The Federal Writers Project succeeded in creating jobs and also in highlighting a sense of national cultural achievement. The American Guide series, of which the Ohio Guide was a part, was intended as a panoramic portrait of the nation. Our new Ohio Guide puts a 21st century spin on that earlier work. The Ohio Humanities Council has asked radio producers from around the state to recreate some of the tours as audio tours, downloadable MP3s that travelers can get for free from the web, pop in their car, and go to explore Ohio. Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
Huffman Prairie doesn't look like much at first. There are no museums or monuments in sight. Not many buildings either. In fact, it looks pretty much like a prairie. But this place oozes history in a way few places can. This is where powered flight became practical, could be controlled, and flights didn't end with faces full of dirt and broken biplanes anymore.
Fort Meigs is the largest wooden fort ever built in North America. And it's easy to see why they built it here. Marching up this 40-foot bluff from the Maumee River seems like suicide for an enemy army.
The place, Akron, Ohio. The time, the morning of August 16th. The excitement, the All-American and International Soapbox Derby Finals.
And then kind of winding around it is Derby Downs, where the All-American Soapbox Derby, probably one of the great defining.
Each week this travel season will take you on a part of a tour. So sit back, listen, and be an armchair traveler for the Road Trip radio series. I'm Sandra Slight Brennan.
Join us for Road Trip as we explore the Buckeye State every Sunday and Monday from now until September. At WISO.org, you'll find a podcast of this series. To download the free audio tours, go to SeeOhioFirst.org. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for listening. Last week, we told you about the upcoming Sinclair Community College presentation of The Laramie Project, a play that deals with the brutal 1998 kidnapping and murder of Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming. Sinclair will host a week-long series of events leading up to the play. To find out more, I spoke with Stephen Skiles. He chairs the theater and dance department at Sinclair.
We're actually producing the play, The Laramie Project, that opens May 18th here at Sinclair Community College, and it'll run for 2 weeks. But about 2 weeks prior to that production, May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, one of the associate writers on The Laramie Project and one of the original actors from The Laramie Project, his name is Greg Perotti, and he's going to be coming to town to join us for 3 days, May 1st through 3rd, for a series of diversity events that relate directly to the themes and some of the issues that come out of the play, The Laramie Project.
And for listeners who aren't familiar with that, can you tell us about the original Laramie Project?
Sure. The Laramie Project is a play that came out of the tragedy of Matthew Shepard's death in Laramie, Wyoming in 1998. And Matthew was a 20-year-old student at the University of Wyoming who was killed by two other young men because he was gay. And in a few weeks after the event took place and Matthew passed away, the Tectonic Theater Project, a group of them, went out to Laramie, Wyoming and conducted over 200 interviews with residents of Laramie and some individuals that were directly involved in some way with the case. And they took all that information with them and they put together the play, The Laramie Project, which is about the story of Matthew Shepard and about the story of the community of Laramie, Wyoming, and the aftermath of that event.
And I noticed that the event starts off with a really interesting project, community readings from the project.
Yeah, that's a really great aspect of this series of events. We've been teaming with a number of different individuals and organizations in the community, not just on campus, but we've really tried to engage the general community in the Dayton area to get together, in small groups, large groups, if there is a large group, to sit down and just have a reading of the original script, The Laramie Project, kind of like a book club setting, if you will, and then to discuss some of the themes and the issues that were raised from the play, just to kind of give them an idea of what the play's about and some of the issues that are raised within it.
I wanted to ask about the organizations behind this and let our listeners know about the diversity grant for Sinclair Theater and also the Bright Signal Alliance. Can you talk about those two elements?
Sure. You know, this goes back over about a year ago when we originally in the theater department decided to do Laramie in our season this year. And Laramie was originally an idea brought to us by one of our students who thought that it would be a really good idea to produce that play and thought that it was an important play, not just for Sinclair, but for students in our program. And after hearing some of that information, we got together and thought about what could we do to maybe expand the opportunities that the play would give us and, you know, to maybe start some discussions here on campus about diversity and especially as it relates to LGBT. That idea, grew very, very fast, and we decided to write a cultural diversity grant. We were very excited to be awarded some funds to bring in Greg to participate in this series of events with us. And along the way, we formed a relationship with the Bright Signal Alliance. And this is just an unbelievably terrific group of individuals here on campus that works for LGBT students and LGBT issues, raising awareness. They're in the community, they're all over campus, and they're just a tremendous group of students that bring a lot to campus. And they've been instrumental in working with us and putting this series of events together, getting word out to the community and to students and faculty and staff on campus as well. So it's been a tremendous collaborative effort, not just with the theater program, but with the Bright Signal Alliance and many other departments on campus, the art department, the American Sign Language department. So we've been very fortunate to have a really good group of partners putting this together.
So we've talked about the community readings. What other events do you have on hand?
We have a great series of events. May 1st is a Tuesday, and we have a wide range of events starting on that day. Greg will begin the week by offering a series of workshops, and we're calling those moment workshops. And what moment work is, it's the approach that the Tectonic Theater Project uses in taking a large group of information, a lot of information, and trying to form it into some type of theatrical form to present. So he'll be doing that actually all day Monday, in the morning and in the afternoon. And if there's anybody listening who would like to take part in that, we have a Facebook page. And it's just if they go to Facebook and look up Laramie at Sinclair, they'll find the page. And there's an application there that they can get online and download it and fill it out and send it back in to us. And this is on a Tuesday, all day from 9 to 1. Then there'll be break from 1 to 2. And then again from 2 to 6. And then again, actually on Thursday, there's a follow-up workshop with that same group, Thursday, May the 3rd, from 10 to 1. So it's a really great way to get the series of events started. And then later on, we'll be having an open reception with Greg at Press Coffee House. And anybody that would like to come and meet Greg and talk about the series of diversity events that we're going to be putting on, and that starts at 7 o'clock at Press Coffee House on Wayne, right outside of the Oregon District. And that'll be like from 7 to 9 o'clock. Throughout the rest of the week on Wednesday, we're ending our day Wednesday with a really exciting event at 7 o'clock here on campus, and it's going to be held in Building 8 on Sinclair's campus. And we're having an open reading and panel discussion, and the reading is going to be of the Laramie Project 10 Years Later script. And in 2008, what Tectonic did is they went back to Laramie and conducted a whole bunch more interviews, many with the same people that they interviewed in 1998, and they put all that information together into a separate look at the Laramie community. And so really what the plays present is an outstanding look at the community in 1998 in Laramie and the community in 2008 and ways that they've changed and ways that they have not. And then Greg Perotti will be the centerpiece of a panel discussion that we hope to have in which we talk about Laramie in 98, Laramie in 08, how they changed, and how do we view Dayton through that same lens, because ultimately that's kind of the point of the whole series of events is to not just look from far off at Laramie and say, wow, that was a tragic event that happened to Matthew, but to use that information in these two plays particularly to take a look at ourselves and to see how is diversity important here in Dayton. And to talk about the idea that hate is not a Dayton value. And so we want to be able to take a look at ourselves and to have a conversation about that. And then Thursday evening, we're going to culminate the experience of Greg being here on town in the Oregon District at 7 o'clock, meeting at the Garden Station. And we're going to have a diversity walk and candlelight vigil from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock. And then after we get back to the Garden Station, we'll do a closing ceremony. The Dayton Gay Men's Chorus is teaming with us. They're going to perform a couple of songs. And we have some terrific speakers from the community and on campus that are going to be there as well. Greg Perotti will be one of those speakers. We have members of the Bright Signal Alliance who are going to speak and several other exciting speakers as well. Nan Whaley, I think, is going to be joining us for a quick talk. PFLAG will be represented there. Mike Castle from Cross Creek will be there as well. And so we have a terrific group of speakers. And then we'll culminate that evening by going to the trolley stop. We've been working with them, where we're going to have a big party afterwards. The Ruby Girls are going to perform for us. Thursday night's the open mic night at the trolley stop. And so they're asking people to show up and do performances based on diversity and acceptance and love, those types of thematic ideas. And that'll kind of conclude the series of events.
And just reiterate, if you will, for us, the impact that you hope this program will have.
You know, I'll talk a little bit about my experience in theater and my hope for it. And, you know, as a theater artist in my career, you often work on plays that are difficult. You know, the subject matter is difficult. Like, I can remember doing a production of Cabaret a number of years ago. And Cabaret is a musical that dealt with the Holocaust and, discrimination and the killing of so many people. And going into rehearsal every night, it's exciting because you're in rehearsal. But it's difficult sometimes wrestling with that subject matter. And kind of at the end of the night, sometimes you'll find yourself thinking, why am I doing this to myself? Why am I coming in every night and I've got the weight of 7 million people on my shoulders, you know, for example, with that particular play? And the answer always is that the hope is that by doing this play, one day the issue will no longer be relevant. And I think that's one of the big ideas behind this series of diversity events, that it's important to do. It's important to put a series of events together that we can engage in discussions, but also hopefully come to some sort of action at the end. That's not just stop hate in our community, or we want to raise awareness of LGBT issues, or we want to talk about diversity, but that we look at it in a way that gives us an opportunity to say, at the end of this, hopefully we have an appreciation that causes us to not just step back and say, I want to accept people that are different, but I want to nurture them. And so the hope is that we do a series of events like this to raise awareness, to start a discussion, and the ultimate hope that one day a diversity event like this will no longer be relevant.
Stephen Skiles, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You can get more information on the Laramie Project events at Laramie@Sinclair on Facebook, and there's an email address, laramie@sinclair@gmail.com. April is National Poetry Month, and the Dayton Metro Library celebrated with an afternoon featuring the works of some local poets heard each week on Conrad's Corner. For the next couple of weeks, we'll be bringing you poetry from that event, starting now with Marion Schwoke Thomas from Vandalia.
This poem that I wrote is a friend of mine, a young man, planted a hibiscus plant in front of my house. I am not a gardener. But this hibiscus really is beautiful. So I wrote a poem about it. To a bright hibiscus. When first I took notice of you, a tall, aggressive weed came to mind. You, a servant of God, had chosen to live and die by my door. Now I come here to watch you as you assemble your beauty. May I watch your ceremony of unfolding silence as your pods transform? I think they contain great secrets tightly folded, safely hidden from human thought, ready to unfold only when the secret is used up. As you awaken, your death begins, a beautiful death. These blooms have memories that I cannot describe, nor would I. My words or even a painting cannot make you any more stunning. Crowds do not gather to offer love songs, only the cicada. You become complete, and then you are gone, taking your secrets with you. No burial for such beauty, returning where you came from. No one weeps for you. I mourn for you, a selfish mourning. You taught me to notice. And my second poem is kind of short. It's called Pavan for a Pen. While waiting to die, I will write poetry. Words lining up in my pen. Blue ink to please me. I cradle the barrel like a musical instrument, and when the sound begins, I continue the dance. Place this pen in my coffin. Let the ink rise as incense searching for words to praise my creator. Thank you.
The poetry of Marion Schwoke Thomas on Why So Weekend. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. The Ohio Military Hall of Fame for Valor was established in 2000 to recognize Ohio servicemen and women who were decorated for heroism while in combat situations. Next week, the 13th annual induction ceremony takes place in Veterans Plaza at the Ohio State House. Ted Mosher is the board president for the Hall of Fame. I spoke with him about the history of the organization.
There was a group of us meeting for lunch, and one of the fellows, Ed Arthur from Lancaster, had an idea to recognize Ohio's veterans who had been awarded a medal for valor in combat. Ohio has a Veterans Hall of Fame, which recognizes Ohio's veterans for their service to the community, the veterans community, and the community at large. but not veterans who have been awarded a Medal for Valor in Combat.
And so have you been involved with since 99 or 2000?
I have. It's the classic, you know, you get an organization started, and I kid people that I missed a meeting, so I got made the president of the board of directors.
This year's ceremony is on Friday, May 4th. At the State House, and you've got the support of the governor.
That's correct. The governor, where I am told as of yesterday, is not sure whether he'll be able to make that, but the Department of Veterans Services for the state of Ohio works closely with us. You know, we're a nonprofit organization, a 501c19. We don't get any direct state funding per se, but we do have their support in our efforts.
And let's talk a little bit about the ceremony. It looks like you've got, you know, the call to order and the posting of colors, all the things that make these ceremonies that I've attended pretty powerful events.
Yes, thank you. This year we had a request from a group near Chillicothe. There's going to be second graders singing two patriotic songs, one of which is an original composition, just prior to the ceremony. The ceremony is scheduled for 11:30 to start, and we keep it to 1 hour. And in between the dignitaries' remarks, what we do is ask our inductees to step forward. We present them with an Ohio Medal for Valor. We have various proclamations from the Ohio Senate, Governor's Office, the Ohio House of Representatives, and some congressional proclamations. Then we will close. You know, we've got a color guard from the Ohio State University who will present colors and close the ceremony. And we will have a reception at AMVETS Post 89 on Westerville Road in Columbus for those inductees and their friends and family members.
And what kind of crowds you draw every year?
We usually get 400 to 600 assembled, which pretty much fills the area that we use.
Ted Mosier, President, Board of Directors with the Ohio Military Hall of Fame for Valor. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate your interest and support.
This year's class of inductees includes representatives from the U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps who served during World War II, as well as conflicts in Korea, Vietnam, and the Middle East. There are four inductees from the Miami Valley we honor today on Why So Weekend. Boatswain's Mate, First Class Harlan K. Sims of Dayton. Sims served in the Navy in 1944 and received the Bronze Star for Valor. Army Sergeant First Class Stephen R. Mikes of Springfield, the Iraq War veteran, also received the Bronze Star. Air Force Staff Sergeant Daryl E. Vaughn of Lebanon, he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross during his service in Vietnam. And Philip Wolford of Fairborn, he was awarded a Silver Star, the military's third highest award for valor in the face of the enemy.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. Today I'm talking with Bill Hershey, the former Statehouse Bureau Chief for the Dayton Daily News. Thanks for talking, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Here it is, a presidential election year, and the Ohio Republican and Democratic parties both have had their dust-ups involving their leaders in that quadrennial moment when they're supposed to be at their most united. How important are party chairmen anyway?
Party chairmen are important, particularly in a presidential election year, because they do have to keep the party united. They have to identify their vote and then make sure they get these voters to the poll. It's the kind of the grunts do this work. It's not the multi-million-dollar television advertising, but in its own way, it's just as important. And in a close election, they can really make a big difference. I think most recently in Ohio, we saw that in 2004 with President George W. Bush's reelection effort. The Ohio Republican Party and the Bush campaign worked hand in hand to get all their voters to the poll.
Ohio Democratic Chairman Chris Redfern got a scare when several unions, including the United Auto Workers, came after him this year. But when the 66-member Central Committee voted this month, Redfern easily defeated his challenger. What was that all about?
Well, it could have been about what happened in 2010. That's the year Democrats lost everything but their shirt. But I really think it was more about 2014. Chris Redfern is a strong supporter of former Governor Ted Strickland, a Democrat. In fact, Strickland helped Redfern win the state chairmanship against Montgomery County's Dennis Lieberman in 2005. And if Governor Strickland or ex-Governor Strickland wants to run for governor again in 2014, Redfern's expected to back him strongly. And some Democrats think Richard Cordray, the former attorney general, would be a better candidate.
The Republican feud arguably has been more interesting because the coup organizers actually prevailed. And Fairborn's Kevin DeWine was ousted and former Republican Chairman Bob Bennett was brought back. Bennett had groomed DeWine for his old job, but when push came to shove, Bennett sided with Governor John Kasich. What was the complaint?
Governor Kasich never was very specific publicly about why he wanted rid of Kevin DeWine. The most descriptive quote I had from him or heard about him was, quote, "I just think we need to have somebody that's going to unite everybody inside the party." And that goes back to the chairman's job to keep the party united, particularly in a presidential election year. I don't think it was that so much. It's nothing new. Chairman of Democratic parties, Republican parties, always want to have their own person in the job. Kevin DeWine was not John Kasich's person, and he was suspect because he was good friends with John Husted, the Secretary of State, who used to be from the Dayton area. I don't think John Husted would challenge Kasich for the governor's nomination in 2014, but maybe Governor Kasich thought he would.
Kevin DeWine hasn't said what he's going to do next. Do you think he's just going to slink away?
No, he's not slinking. He called me up the other day to say, talk about all the conversations we've had in the past. And he said he was looking at some business opportunities. And he also is going to serve on the Republican National Committee as one of the representatives from Ohio.
You recently wrote a column talking about the challenges Chairman Bennett faces. What does he have to do?
He has to keep the party united. And he said that's not difficult because of the unified disdain for President Obama. However, there's one caveat. There's not that much enthusiasm, or so far we haven't seen that much enthusiasm for Mitt Romney as a candidate. So Bennett has to make sure that people at the local level are excited, that they're going to do the phoning, door knocking, and everything else that has to be done.
In that same column, you also wrote about the legendary Ohio Republican chairman, Ray Bliss. He went on to become national Republican chairman until Richard Nixon sent him packing back to Ohio. You're co-authoring a book about Bliss. Why was he important in Ohio political history?
Late political writer David Broder of the Washington Post once said that there were, he called the three B's, the important national Republican chairman, Ray Bliss, William Brock, who came along after Watergate, and Haley Barbour, who came along after Bill Clinton. And each of these people rebuilt the National Republican Party. Bliss rebuilt it after the 1964 Barry Goldwater disaster for the Republicans. He made the job a profession. He patterned his job after the industry leaders he knew at the Akron tire companies.
I've been talking with Bill Hershey, a longtime political journalist in Ohio. This was fun, Bill. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's good to talk with you.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Last week, the Sunday Documentary Hour took a look at the hunt for oil. This week, we explore the future of coal. Sarah Buckingham has more.
Brew the coffee, turn on the radio, and check your email. You're on your way to burning 20 pounds of coal for the day. That's how much coal the average American uses. No matter what, we all have a stake in coal's future. Tonight's documentary takes an in-depth look at that future. It's called Coal, Dirty Past, Hazy Future, from the Environment Report. Host Lester Graham takes us on a journey from your light switch back to America's coal fields. We start at Thomas Edison's Menlo Park Lab, then visit a coal-burning power-generating station. Go down into a coal mine in Illinois, travel to the rural counties of West Virginia, where mountaintop mining is pulling on the state's social fabric, and take a closer look at the technologies that promise to deliver coal into the new green economy. Coal, Dirty Past, Hazy Future, explores the effects of coal in our lives and in the lives of those who depend on coal for a living. That's tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all of our guests, and thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. Coming up next, The Book Nook.
I'm Susan Stamberg, special correspondent for NPR News. For more years than I wish to admit, my voice has been coming out of your radio, in your car, in your kitchen, your office. I think it's time we met. June 29th, I'll be in Dayton in support of WYSO. Finally, I'll get a chance to see what you look like.
It's a benefit for WYSO at the Dayton Art Institute. Go to WYSO.org for tickets or call us at 769-1387.
This week on American Roots, the funk soul universe from New Orleans to New York, including all things funky with Stanton Moore and Ben Elman from the band Galactic. Then East Harlem's king of Latin soul, Joe Batan. Plus music from Stevie Wonder, Dr. John, and Joe Cuba. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
This afternoon at 2 on your public radio station, WYSO.